reading what issues in human life that leads people to want to look for easy answers or blueprints for the future and such. And then we looked on Tuesday at secular approaches to replace biblical approaches to respond to end-of-the-world kind of scenarios, or more broadly speaking, messages from beyond in that apocalyptic sense we've been looking at, where apocalyptic is lifting the veil, is looking beyond the surface of reality to that deeper reality to find in the Bible as where God lives, or sometimes as heaven, the various means provided to get insight beyond the veil. In the Bible, it's through prayer, through visions, through dreams. And we looked at through secular means how that could be visits from outer space or near-death experiences or other kinds of things like that. Yesterday we looked at one of the two tools I hope to be offering here that give you resources to read this book of Revelation apart from end-of-the-world scenarios and that kind of thinking, way of thinking. So yesterday we looked at the roots in terms of Hebrew scripture and the social context of apocalyptic literature, specifically the world of Daniel and First Maccabees, where, as we saw, empire was right in people's face in a very violent and vicious way. Today we'll see a different kind of empire that's much more seductive and less obvious in terms of its trying to get people to abide by its worldview. And we also looked briefly at the earlier period where Ezra and Nehemiah were in conflict with 3rd Isaiah in terms of the relationship between the community of God's people and so-called helpful empires. In that case, the Persian Empire, which provided colonial peace on behalf of the restored Jerusalem community. Okay, so that's where we've been. Today we're going to look at what it was like to live in the cities of Roman Asia in the first century, and a little bit about what it might have meant to be a Christian in that context. So that's where we were, and we might as well start the tape now, and we'll launch into this. To make this concrete today, as we look at the imperial cult, I'd like to start by giving you a set of maps, three different views of the scene we're looking at. Again, if you're part of a couple, I'd invite you just to take one copy. That might not be enough for everybody. And if you don't need a copy, you can look on with your neighbor and maybe get some more later. As you'll see, there's kind of a wide-angle view and a closer up and an up-close view. You'll see that this whole area known as Asia Minor was divided into a number of provinces in the Roman Empire. The one we're looking at in particular is the province of Asia, where these seven cities are. To give ourselves some geographic clarity, I know some of you may have even been there. Where are we talking about in the world today? Is anybody who knows? Turkey. Okay. So this is the coast of Turkey, these seven cities. There's nothing we know for sure about why these particular seven cities. They're not necessarily the most important or the biggest cities in the Roman province of Asia. They're obviously not the only cities, as you can see from the wider view of the map. They're not necessarily even the only cities that have Christian communities in them. And in fact, other than these chapters in Revelation, some of these cities, Christian communities, all we know about them is what's in Revelation. Others like Ephesus, we obviously know more about because of Paul's writing, or at least writings attributed to Paul and others. And also with Smyrna, which was the home of the famous Bishop Polycarp, who was martyred in the early second century, who was written up and became famous. So why these seven, we don't know exactly. But what's important here is to understand what it was like to live in cities in the ancient world in general, and in particular to be in cities in the Roman Empire in this particular place. So I'd like to just start more generally, and I recognize that it's a lot more fun when we can do more interactive sessions. Tomorrow will be a lot more interactive. Tomorrow, when we actually look at the messages to these communities, I'll really invite us to consider, you know, what does this mean for us a little more. But I think before we can jump into that, it really helps to know something of the context so you can read those chapters on your own or the rest of the book of Revelation with some sense of what it was like for the original audience. So bear with me if it seems more lecture than discussion. But also, please feel free to jump in. If you have questions or you're not sure what I'm saying or you disagree, please do feel free to jump in. Okay. We ended yesterday, Mary Alette had asked a question about cities in the Bible and biblical attitudes towards cities, and I just was able to trace very briefly this business about going back to Enoch, the first city, this suspicion of cities. Mythologized in the book of Genesis as this hiding place from God, this place where Enoch, you know, who's cast out of God's presence, builds this place. You know, it's obviously a symbol. You know, city building is not a one-man operation, as it's attributed there, especially when there weren't too many other people around in the story world at that point to occupy it. But a symbol from the Hebrew term ir, I-R, what a city was more mythologically and theologically. At the political and everyday level, it's taking up in the cities of Asia what cities were in the ancient world, which was protection from enemies. Before there were cities and people lived in villages, if bands came through, tribal bands, and were marauding, and it was harvest time, or it was winter and food was short, and you had stores of food, under your mat or in your cupboard, what protected you from them? Not much. And so the tendency to build both storehouses for food and walls around where you lived began to become a situation where people could be protected from enemies. Because land was at a premium, the city area was often separated out from the agricultural area, and so the city area was as small a space as possible in which to enclose people and build a surrounding wall. So one of the first things to recognize is that almost all ancient cities were very dense, densely populated. The handful of really rich people that were in cities could have estates, not unlike the southern estates, antebellum situation in America, where there'd be the big plantation house and the workers, but they could live in great splendor. But that was a very few people. The overwhelming majority of people in cities were poor people or artisans or small merchants, peasants, folks just trying to get by on a daily basis. And they tended to live in poorly constructed apartment buildings that were two or three, sometimes four stories high. Life in those cities was literally unstable. The buildings were fire hazards and didn't come up to code, as we might say, and could fall down with the slightest tremor or no cause at all, apparently, just bad construction. So life was, as they say, literally unstable and uncertain. Streets were narrow. They obviously weren't didn't create streets for cars. They created streets for animals and for people to walk through. And because they didn't have what we think of as some of the basic elements of cities, like plumbing, sewage, the streets were basically open sewers. So in addition to being smelly and dirty, they were dangerous in terms of disease. So cities were not pleasant places in that regard. They were also physically dangerous, in addition to the risk of, literally the risk of bricks falling on you, or getting disease, or being stepped on by somebody's animal, or kicked at, or stepping in manure, or open sewage, all those kinds of horrible things. They were physically dangerous because of two factors that led the occupants of the cities to be people who were desperate in one way or another. In the village life, that was the life that we see portrayed in the Gospels, villages in that world were largely networks of extended family. You might find in a given village that perhaps only five or six different bloodlines existed, and they often intermarried and overlapped. So that everybody you knew in a village of 300 or 400 was related to you in one way or another, or people that you've known ancestrally for perhaps hundreds of years. Cities were not like that for two reasons that I have up from the morning session already on the board. One was warfare. Cities before the Roman Empire, especially in this area, tended to compete with one another, ruled over by tribal chieftains, or often the chief of chiefs, that are referred to in the Bible and other ancient literature as kings. We shouldn't project onto that, the grand and glorious element, sense of king that we get from European kings, this royal throne and a court and, all that kind of paraphernalia of royalty. But much more sort of like a tribal chief, someone who's in charge of extended network of people who had been there over the course of time in this small area. It's probably not that different than some of the situations that underlie some of the ethnic struggles in places like the Balkans or in Africa or in other places where tribal warfare is the way of life, ethnic warfare. In these walled cities, competition would take the form of, we would go out and, invade their city
to prove that we were better or stronger, or that our gods were more powerful than theirs. When the Roman Empire came, it was, of course, in its own eyes, the great civilizer. It produced, they have up here, the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome. One of the effects of the Peace of Rome was to suppress the competition among cities, at least in the form it took of invasions from one city to the other. You know, it's not that different, really, than what you saw during the period of the Soviet Union, where many of the ethnic rivalries that, you know, sprung up once the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, back into full flower, had been suppressed by the military, the greater military power and propaganda of the Soviet Union. In a similar way, when the Roman Empire took over these city-states, these kings, small kingdoms, they required people to be at peace, primarily so the empire could extract whatever wealth was there and without resistance, so they could charge taxes. And you see, of course, the tax issues in the Gospels, with the question of should we pay tax to the Romans, you know, is an issue people try and trick Jesus with. So Roman taxation was a big factor, and it required people being calm in place, and, you know, as we see with the relationship with Herod in Jerusalem, similarly in these places, the Roman Empire would make deals with the local elite who would keep the people quiet and promote the Roman point of view. It's interesting historically to see that the Roman Empire, really until this century, has been viewed as this benign and wonderful civilizing force, primarily under the influence of, you know, Edward Gibbon's multi-volume Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Now remember where Gibbon lived when he wrote that, in the midst of the British Empire. Wrote it at a time where the British Empire was struggling with this little colonial problem in the New World, and was trying hard to proclaim, you know, what a wonderful and grand thing empire was. And so Gibbon's work, in a large way, was a propagandistic attempt to justify the British Empire in terms of showing how wonderful its ancestor was in terms of the Roman Empire. Many of our inherited views of how great the Roman Empire was come from Gibbon's highly partisan presentation. More recent scholarship has looked beyond Rome's own self-image, which, you know, is propaganda in the most literal sense, you know, is a veil, as we looked at in the apocalyptic language, presented to lead people to believe that the way the Roman Empire created the world is the way the gods want the world to be. It's the culmination of the divine struggle, and now it's presented, and there's peace, and there's calm, and there's civilization, there's art, and literature, and music, and anybody who thinks that isn't wonderful is either crazy or a heretic, okay? Going against the divine order. Okay? Now, you can begin to see already, just in the very nature of the Roman Empire, that it's going to ask you, well, if you're a Christian, what do you think about that? But that's only the broad overarching structure of it. As we're going to look now, we'll look a little more closely and see how that expressed itself in people's daily life in ways that made this really quite a challenge for Christians in that context. One of the primary ways that happened is through what we know broadly as the imperial cult, the worship of Caesar as God. You know, it's interesting to note that in the early period of the Roman Empire, Caesar Augustus, for example, the very fact that someone whose name is Octavian took on the title Augustus was a way of claiming some connection with the gods. But up until later first century, and especially springing directly from the area we're talking about in Asia, none of the emperors had been worshipped as gods in their lifetime. They were viewed as being representatives of the gods, perhaps, but not actually being divine. The tradition was the apotheosis of the emperor, the rising up of the emperor after he died to Olympian status. And of course, some of you may know the very famous painting, the apotheosis of George Washington and others, that, you know, are in Washington, D.C., with it playing on that tradition of the founding fathers as being, you know, with the gods. Beginning in the Roman province of Asia, though, began this movement to worship the emperors during their lifetime as divine. So to start with, let's ask ourselves the question, why would people want to do that? Why would people in the Roman province of Asia, who, and now we're talking late first century, the emperor's Domitian, as far as we know, Domitian never went to Asia, so why would they want to worship someone as divine that they'd never seen, never met, and lived in this distant place? Why do they want to do that?
could have been some threats.
Threat? What kind of threat are you thinking?
Either economic or, if you, well, such as in China now, if you dare, anyone knows you're a Christian or you have a Bible in your house, it's all over.
Okay. Well, let's look at it. It's a good question to raise. Let's separate that out a little bit. If we were looking at the situation that we saw yesterday under the Seleucids, where the king Antiochus Epiphanes commanded, all shall be one people, and you can't practice your ancestral ways, then I think we'd be in more of a system of a totalitarian, you know, what we think of as an atheistic, I don't think there's really such a thing as atheistic, but that's another issue. A different religious system imposing itself and insisting you give allegiance to its particular religious system. We're not dealing with that here. This is something where the people in Asia began on their own to offer worship to the emperor as divine. And in fact, the emperors at first resisted it, whether it's out of kind of false modesty or out of a real concern of, no, wait a minute, you know, it's one thing to be honored, it's another thing to be treated as divine. But the records seem to show that they uniformly resisted it until it was insisted upon so strongly by the people starting in Asia and then spreading around the Roman Empire that they allowed it to happen. So it began from below and worked up. So why? Why would people in these cities...
Would you say that's human nature? Could they want
someone? Is that security, a real presence?
Security. What kind of security might it provide?
Then they wouldn't have to be totally responsible for themselves.
Wouldn't have to be responsible for themselves. Okay, we're starting to get at it.
Were they feeling on the fringes of the empire? And I can't remember geographically where we are.
Yeah, well, Italy's over here, and then, you know, Turkey's over here, so Asia's, it's a little ways away. We're getting at that a little bit. How are we connected to this distant outpost of Rome that most of us have never seen, haven't even seen in pictures? You know, the way we think of our modern world, we've at least seen photographs of distant places. Maggie, you know the answer. But go ahead. It's my wife, for those of you who don't know.
Is this the competition with the other local religions?
Okay. Well, competition with the other cities is the issue. Okay. Notice I mentioned that the cities were competing with one another until the Pax Romana came along. Now they don't compete in terms of warfare, but those ethnic tensions are still there. How do they express themselves? They express themselves in a couple of ways. One of those ways that these tensions amongst the cities express themselves that's related to this imperial cult issue are the games. Got that up here. Now, the most famous of the games, of course, are the Olympics that we've restored in our era. And the Olympics provide a similar kind of function on the international level, competition among nations. It's kind of harmless in some way, but people take it pretty seriously. And every time there's an event, the national song is sung and the flag is put out. And it's as much an issue of patriotism and nationalism as it is athletic competition. You know, at the much more local level, the games in the ancient world were the same thing. You know, Smyrna would have its team, and Ephesus would have its team, and they'd compete against each other. But it wasn't just once every 4 years. It was on a regular basis. And the occasions for the games were almost always some birthday of Caesar or some specific divinity whose celebration took place at a given time and place. It happened all the time. It was much more akin to the football season than it was to the Olympics. And you know how professional sports in our era take on that same question of, you know, us versus them in terms of one city or another. I was talking to one of my workmates the other day, and she was reporting on the Mariners game, and she said, "We won." And I said, "I didn't even know you were on the team." But you see how much we identify with these sports entities as a representation of who we are. And now, of course, the competition, which relates to a different level of what we might get to some next week, of, you know, build us a stadium, you know, or we'll go somewhere else, you know, give our honor to some other city, the honor of having our team here. Okay. So the games were a place in which the cities could compete with one another, but the ostensible occasion for the games was always a religious event. Always, you know, a participation in the imperial cult, participation in one of the local cults that we'll get to in a minute. You know, the games are surrounded with rituals at the beginning, middle, and end. just like the Olympics are in terms of nationalistic rituals, of these religious rituals. If you're a Christian, what do? You go to the games? Watch, stay at home and watch on TV? You know, if it seems trivial, just think of the at the basic level, if you go to a major, those of you who live in big cities and have major sports arenas, or perhaps it even happens at your local high school football game, when the national anthem is sung at the beginning, what would happen if you didn't stand up? What might happen? Ever tried it? Ever thought about it at all? I know Randall has, but...
I knelt, but since I'm 6'5", nobody noticed.
I mean, it was a real question for some Christians, and part of the point is, in the same way that perhaps here a group of Christians don't even think about whether to stand at the national anthem, we're probably wondering, why is he even asking that? By this time, many Christians would have thought, what do you mean we can't participate in these? These are just the civic realities of the world we live in. How could we not participate in it? It's just part of the air we breathe. It's part of the world around us. You know, I don't understand how we could live and not be a part of that, unless we were going to, you know, risk our lives. That's part of the question, isn't it? Okay. The games were one piece, and actually a relatively small piece. In the same way that football and sports are a relatively small piece of the structures of patriotism and such in our country. The bigger piece of the imperial cult, and what it really was getting to, in addition to competition amongst the cities, was involved in this pyramid of patronage, which was the structure of the entire ancient world, but in particular of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire made a science out of what was an informal process of relationships in the ancient world, both at the village level and in cities. The patronage system basically presents life in a pyramidal structure like this, where the large majority of people are at the bottom, and somebody is at the top. In the imperial case, obviously, the emperor, Caesar. In a local community, it might be the richest person in town who's at the top. And the issue is, how do we who are at the bottom get access to goods and services, money, that we don't have access to, that are higher up on the pyramid from us? You know, we have to stop and think about this for a bit, because we live in a world where our social structure is at least a myth of upward mobility. You know, punctuated by some prominent examples of people who, you know, started off with nothing, and education, hard work, luck, grace, combination, found themselves in positions of power and status, etc. Whether it's sports heroes or people with particular talents or CEOs of corporations, you know, we know many examples of that. That didn't happen in the ancient world. If you were born a peasant or an ordinary working person, you didn't become the emperor. You know. You didn't become a large landowner. It just didn't happen that way. So if you needed access to resources that weren't at your level, what did you do? How could you get them? You couldn't buy them. You know, almost by definition, you couldn't afford them. That's what makes them at a higher level. What do you do? Let's think of a concrete example. Say you're in one of these cities and your aqueduct breaks. How do you get it fixed?
You ask.
Who do you ask?
Caesar.
Caesar's a long way away. Let's just start at the local level, right here in Smyrna.
Go to the richest guy.
Go to the richest guy. Why should the richest guy pay for it?
Because he'll get something back from you.
Okay, what'll he get back?
Your loyalty and maybe some work.
Loyalty and maybe you'll name the restored aqueduct after him. Right? That's how it works. You know, in exchange for goods and services, the patron gets honor and loyalty. Builds up both a body of people who are loyal, patronage, you know, that's the old sense in that if people remember, somebody old enough to remember the Chicago patronage Democratic Party system under the first Mayor Daley and such, you know, when party politics actually meant something in this country. You know, where it wasn't just a label, but was a system of establishing from the local level upward to the party machinery, upward to the mayor or the governor or the president. You know, a system where I can promise you some votes. You know, I can turn out the people on election day. Okay, so you would have, at one level, you'd curry favor amongst the group of people who would owe loyalty to you. He built our aqueduct, so therefore. you see that in the story in the gospel where the Gentile centurion comes up and they encourage Jesus to heal the person's son because he said he's been very generous to our people. And that's a system of a situation of patronage and honor there. So you, when the patron needs something, you speak on their behalf and you honor them publicly, both verbally and in written things like inscriptions, and you name things after them. You know, we know that in every bridge and library and museum and church building, it's named after the big donors. Okay, so that's how that worked. At the local level, it worked in terms of the local rich person. At the imperial level, it worked in terms of the emperor. So if you're in Ephesus and you want to compete with those no-good Smyrnians next, you know, down the road, the way you do it is by getting the empire to feel like you're offering more loyalty to them than the neighbors do. And in exchange, they give you stuff. You know, it's what we think of in our system as bringing home the bacon. You know, the pork barrel politics that has your representative go to Washington, D.C. and bring back money for your local road construction project or whatever it might be that gets, in exchange, they get reelected. That's why, you know, in general, the polls show that people don't trust Congress, but they like their congressperson. It's a paradox at some level, but as long as they're doing good for us here, even though we don't like what's happening in the country, you know, things are, they're doing their job for us. Okay? That's how the system worked. It worked at the grand level in terms of imperial cult temples. And the grandest of all was on the hill overlooking the harbor in Ephesus, one of our seven cities, where from archaeological remains we can see that not only was the temple huge, but the statue of the emperor that sat in the temple was about 180 feet high. Pretty big for the ancient world. You could see it from out in the water. Ships coming in would see this huge statue of the emperor. Ephesus was such a powerful city in terms of its imperial cult worship that it was named, the title, it was said to be twice Neocros. Neocros meant temple warden. It was this honorific title for a city, not for just for an individual, who had the honor, the great honor, of housing an imperial cult temple. Okay, well, that's a imperial cult temple is sort of like having a cathedral in your town. It's not like having a local church. It's having this grand thing, grand spectacular thing. The temples, of course, are just the icing on the cake of the structure of imperial cult worship. That's why it's important to see how this affects daily life. At one extreme is the temple. At the other extreme are coins with the emperor's picture on them. You know, you think of the story in the Gospels where they say, is it fair to, you know, pay taxes to Caesar? And Jesus says, bring me the coin. Whose face is on it? And whose inscription? The implication there being, you're the ones who have Caesar's coin, not me. I didn't have one in my pocket. You know, we're so used to a national currency system that we forget that in the ancient world, economic exchange in terms of money and coins was an unusual thing. Most people bartered. So to have the imperial coin was not commonplace the way it is to have, you know, coins with presidents' pictures on them for us. Okay, but they were on the coins, a small thing that would be in your pocket in contrast with the Grand Temple. They were also on every street corner, in local shrines, you know, water fountains, and every kind of possible civic object had pictures of Caesar, inscriptions to their glory, and indications of divine status everywhere. Now, at one level, that's just the visual phenomenon. It's the scenery. You think, well, I can still be a Christian and just ignore it. But you need to recognize, it's like trying to say, I don't have to watch TV. Yeah, you don't have to. But first of all, how many of us choose not to? And second of all, even if you don't, it still structures our reality. It's still out there, shaping everybody else's mind, everybody you deal with, even if you choose not to watch it. And if anything, not watching it makes you strange. As my 8-year-old son, who doesn't get to watch Pokemon on Saturday morning. What a mean daddy I am. Okay, so it's out there. It's forming a fabric of your life, but that's only part of it. Because, you know, we have to recognize that in the ancient world, religion and business, politics, economics, were not separate realities like they are for us. You know, we know that we don't have to go and pay any attention to other people's churches or synagogues or mosques or anything. We don't have to read their holy books. We don't have to engage in their practices. It's all done in private. You know, it's all done behind closed doors of your house or your church or wherever it is. And we can completely ignore it and not be a part of it. And when you go into a store, no one asks you to light incense to the God they believe in to get into the store. Okay? In the ancient world, you did. And there wasn't stores in the same way like we think of it as open-air marketplaces. But the entire world participated in this worship in one way or another. At the daily level, it could be offering incense. It could be having a picture or some kind of statue, you know, all around. At another deeper structural level, the places where business took place were in these temples or local versions of them. Okay. The Grand Temple in Ephesus was a bank, among other things. That may strike us as odd, but once you think about it and realize how much sense it makes, it's a very, very strong building that's got people there all the time. They're taking care of it. It's a safe place to put your money. It's watched over. And therefore, if you're doing business, not daily business, I mean, not, you know, buying food and that kind of stuff, but you're buying and selling land. You know, you're buying cargoes of grain or international trade, you go to the temples and engage in that kind of business. That's where you do it, away from other places where you can exchange large sums of money in safety or engage in written contractual documents and know that they're not going to be torn up and no one's going to run away with them the wrong way. Okay. So if you're a Christian and you have any sense of participating in business at the high level, that's where you do it, where worship of Caesar is happening all around you. And documents are sealed with statements about Caesar being divine. Can you participate in that if you're a Christian? What if you say, as the Corinthians did to Paul, well, what if we know that it's not, we don't really worship Caesar, but we just kind of say the words and we, you know, but in our hearts, in our minds, we don't really do it. You know, that's a struggle in 1 Corinthians 8 to 10 about, can we eat the meat that's, you know, being offered to the gods before the entertainment? Because we know they're not really gods, they're just statues. So can't we just, you know, go, yeah, yeah, and have our fingers crossed and eat the steak anyway? And what does Paul say?
What kind of example are you setting,
what kind of example are you setting for others? In particular, what kind of others does he say? Who is the concern for?
The
so-called weak. You know, those who aren't quite sure. You know, who say, sure, looks like they're eating the meat sacrificed to idols, it must be okay to worship the idols.
Right.
You know, we can't tell Christian practices here from the idol practices. It all looks about the same to me. And Paul says, well, don't scandalize those people. You know, so give up the piece of meat, and not only give up the piece of meat, you know, the taste treat, but give up sharing the meal with those whom you're about to do this business deal with. Maybe they won't even deal with you if you don't eat the meal with them. You know, that's part of the struggle here. Okay, it operates, you know, at the smallest pieces of daily life. One more piece of how this operates. Before we get to that, let's look at a different kind of religion here. And I want to note that when we're talking religion in the Latin sense, where the word comes from, religio, which is, you know, to bind together again. It's any system that holds people together as a common people. So, you know, we obviously generally think of religion as something about God and religious practices and reading the Bible, or I don't know if you think what we're doing here is religion or not exactly, but, you know, we have a pretty good sense of what that's about. It's not about going to the bank. It's not about going to your union meeting. It's not about, you know, the ordinary stuff of daily life. The cities were populated by people who were victims often of warfare. I didn't notice this in complete detail, but let's go back to that. Of warfare. I got to the Pax Romana, didn't get to this. When the Romans would come through Samaria and conquer it, and burn and plunder and pillage, where did people go who used to live there? They'd go to whatever the next town was and try and get by. So the cities, in addition to being dirty and unclean and stuff, were populated by people who were often desperate and often alienated, who had no natural relationships with the people around them. In great contrast, as they say, with the villages, where people were linked by centuries of family and other kinship bonds. The other form of migration that led to alienation in the city was
the foundation by the Romans of Latitudifundia.
There's a fancy word for you.
The Latin for what we think of as corporate agribusiness. It's the buying up, the systematic buying up of family farms by the rich and turning them into instruments of international trade rather than local consumption.
It's going on today.
Absolutely. I hope you'll see some parallels here, or this is an interesting and intellectual exercise in ancient history, but so what? You know, yes, please feel free to notice the parallels. So what would happen is that there'd be a handful of rich landowners who would own huge, tremendous estates and would gather the produce of those estates for international sale. You know, if you were to look in Revelation 18, you see this tremendously detailed cargo list that the merchants and the sailors and the ship owners are lamenting in fallen Babylon, smoking ruin of Babylon. It gives this great laundry list. And they're all saying, it's all gone in an hour, it's all gone. It's not the ordinary folks who are lamenting, it's the international traders that are lamenting. And what binds that list of goods together, at first it looks like luxury goods, but it's not. It includes wheat and ordinary day-to-day things, is that they're all imports. Every one of those items in Revelation 18, at least from the Roman perspective, was an import from places like Asia and other places, Africa, other places in the empire, where these huge farms were gathered together for the sake of sending the goods to Rome or to other places. So in Roman Asia, there not only some of their produce was taken and sent elsewhere, wonderful spices from India and all kinds of exotic woods from Africa would be available in the marketplace to people who could afford it in Smyrna and Ephesus and places like that. Okay. There are a couple of implications of that. One of those is, though, that the people whose land has been bought up, just like we've seen in our country or in Africa and other places, whether it's because of warfare or economics, migrate to the cities to do what they can, to become day laborers, beggars, whatever, to find some way to get by. And so these cities are filled with people like this who are just trying to make it, who have no natural relationships, are hungry, often unskilled, and there's a lot of crime to go with it, desperate crime. Just theft and violence in order to get by. There's no police force, no security net. None of the institutional systems that we so depend on provide for us in difficult times, whether it's corporate systems like insurance, or government systems like welfare or social security or things like that. Nothing like that. If you're hurt or you're sick, you're in big trouble. In the city, no health insurance, no life insurance. So people form various kinds of forms of religio to bind themselves together, given that they were alienated. They had no natural relationships with people in these cities. They often competed with one another for work, for places to live, for all kinds of daily life things. Okay. One of the common forms of doing that were trade guilds. People that had any skill at all, carpentry or even labor, particular kinds of skilled laborers, would gather together for mutual protection. It's the ancient ancestors of what became unions in our culture, but these weren't for the purpose of bargaining with the owners. These are just for the purpose of banding together for the most minimal levels of support and security. So they would band together and they would pay some dues, and in exchange for the dues, they would have meetings and develop relationships. And the material benefits were that if you got sick, they would care for you. There would be material benefits they'd pay to your family. If you were out on the street and you called help, and there was a member of your trade guild, they'd come to your rescue. So literally, crying for help was the only means available if you were mugged in the street. You'd support each other for physical protection, for economic protection, in case of ill health. The trade guilds, as part of this patronage system, were always overseen by a god or goddess. It was part of the patronage systems that you worshiped the god or goddess, and the goddess protected you, or the god protected you, and the members of your trade guild. So going to a trade guild meeting meant, largely, participating in rituals and celebration and honor of the local god and goddess. What do you do if you're a Christian? Now, this is daily life. This isn't just, I can't go to the football games, you know, and I can't participate in the great civic events. This is daily survival, ordinary life. Okay. Let's look a little bit at a couple of these local cults to get an idea. The one I'd like to really focus on just for a couple of minutes is my favorite, partly because it's so popular and powerful, but also because it's kind of exotic and strange. And that's the cult of the goddess Sibylle. There are others, Isis, that some of you may have heard of from Egypt, and Mithras, and others that were well known. Sibylle was by far the most popular, although Isis was also popular. Sibylle, in the most ancient roots, goes back to worship of the Earth Mother. There are archaeological evidence of worship of Earth Mother goddess for at least 6,000 years, and probably farther back. You know, it doesn't take much religious imagination to see how that comes about. Ever since agriculture, ever since the first people put seeds into the furrow, they understood the earth as sexually female. And the fertility of the earth as being, you know, a female response. And naturally, if the earth was fertile for you, you'd want to offer thanks and do whatever rituals you could to make sure it would happen again next year. So it's a pretty natural human thing to worship the earth as the divine mother. And takes, you know, an infinite number of forms. You know, it might be worth noting parenthetically that when the Israelite prophets got this odd idea of worship of Yahweh alone, you know, strange concept, you know, in the ancient world, we worship only the Sky Father. We don't worship an Earth Mother. There is no Earth Mother. There's only the Sky Father. Well, people said, no, wait a doggone minute here. Our ancestors forever have acknowledged that life has its fertility through this relationship, you know, just like we produce children that way, so does creation, the Sky Father and the Earth Mother, the rain from above and the soil from below. You need both, don't you? The earth isn't very fertile if there's no rain. And similarly, what good is rain if there's no earth? So it's this relationship most ancient religions had as their central imagery, this, you know, divine marriage between the Sky Father and the Earth Mother. What the Israelite prophets were about was stamping out Earth Mother goddess worship. It's interesting sometimes when people on the social justice end of things like to proclaim the prophets as their source for, you know, justice and peace and other things. They were also the ones stamping out, you know, the feminine side of God. Just a little tributary there. Sibylle was because of this very natural reality, worshiped everywhere. The worship of the Earth Mother as Sibylle began in what became the Roman province of Phrygia and spread throughout Asia. It spread to Rome itself and throughout the Roman Empire, even as far as Gaul and Britain. Not as strongly, but it was a very powerful practice and was everywhere. There was a temple to Sibylle on Vatican Hill, right in the midst of Rome. So this is a very powerful reality. A couple things about Sibylle that you might hear echoes of in the book of Revelation. She was portrayed as this powerful woman. She was portrayed as more powerful than the beasts. The Earth Mother is more powerful than the beasts of the earth. So she's often portrayed in relationship with lions, either as being in a cart pulled by lions or sometimes riding astride a lion. Well, you might note in Revelation 18 when it talks about the whore of Babylon astride a beast, that perhaps the people in Asia see behind that image Sibylle as well as this mythical image of incarnate Babylon. We also would note, just to show you the popularity, that Sibylle was assimilated under various other names, one of the most popular of which was Artemis. And, you know, those familiar with the book of Acts might recognize the silversmith's riot in Ephesus, same town here, in Acts, where Paul goes into the silversmiths, think that Paul's correctly trying to put them out of business from building little silver statuettes in honor of Artemis. And so they first try and kill Paul, and Paul manages to get away. And so because they can't kill him, they gather the people to riot in the street for hours. Great is Artemis! Great is Artemis! You know, until the city clerk has to finally stop the whole thing. But they just kind of go around town, and immediately the streets are filled with people chanting this on behalf of this. It's not just the silversmiths themselves, it's everybody. So it's important to see that we're not talking about some weird, obscure little local cult. We're talking about the dominant religion of the area. Okay. You know, she is the patroness of numerous trade guilds. The more popular gods and goddesses got associated with trade guilds, just like the more popular saints get their names on churches. There are obviously a lot of saints that never get their names on churches, and some saints get their names on lots of churches. Cybele, you know, was like having a saint, a very common saint, on your trade guild. Okay, what do you do if you're a Christian? The worship of both the imperial cult and these local cults also expressed itself, besides the more quiet things of trade guilds, with parades and public rituals in the streets all the time. You know, every few days there would be some occasion. There was the birthday of Caesar, or some special feast day of Cybele or somebody. And there you'd be in your tenement, and the streets would be filled with this cacophony of tambourines and drums and dancing and all kinds of stuff. You might think of that in relationship with the scenes of heavenly worship, heavenly liturgy in Revelation, which are always described as loud. Always. You might wonder otherwise, why does it need to be loud in heaven? But they're always singing in a loud voice at the top of their lungs. I suggest one reason is to drown out the imperial cult and the local cult ritual that's going on all around. Again, part of what we need to understand from this apocalyptic worldview that Revelation is trying to get us to see is not that heaven is up there, safely away from the imperial cult, or someplace we go to after we die, or New Jerusalem is at the end of time, but rather, it's right next door. Heaven is where God lives and reigns, on the other side of the veil, wherever that might be. So the heavenly liturgy is not just something up in the sky, it's something that's right next door to the imperial cult and the cult of Cybele that needs to be loud to drown out the sound of what's happening around. And to get the attention of Christians in particular, whose minds and ears are battered by this ongoing noise. Okay? One more thing about the cult of Cybele, and then I'll try and give us a few minutes to say, what does this have to do with us? The cult of Cybele was presided over by priests who in Latin were referred to as Galli, which means roosters, interestingly given what I'm about to tell you too. Part of the story, the myth of Cybele had to do with this incredibly powerful story of sexuality and castration and things that many of the ancient myths we're about. We don't tell those kinds of stories in our world, but the ancients did not hesitate to have as some of their popular stories that kids heard, the whole deal, stories about incest and adultery and all kinds of lusts and jealousies amongst the gods and goddesses. And part of the story in Cybele is that her lover, Attis, and their love is interfered with by another god who's jealous, results in Attis's castration. And part of the cult of, and then Attis dies as a result of his wounds, and then is raised up again. And there was a week of celebration of the cult of Cybele that interestingly took place in the last week in March. Don't think it's 100% coincidence that this ritual, that is really like a holy week, that begins with a procession of pine branches, not palms at least, but pine branches, and culminates with a celebration, a memorial of the death of the god and his resurrection parallels the foundation of Christian Holy Week. But there's more to it than that. The priests, as I started to get to, the Galli, their ordination ritual in memory of this tradition involved a great ritual of frenzied singing and dancing in the streets, and the moment of their ordination was sealed by their self-castration. Seems strange to you, but being a Galli was such a desirable thing, and it was so popular that the Roman Empire had to prohibit its citizens from being participants in it, because it was so popular to be a priest in this tradition. Your guess is as good as mine, folks. Okay. So in addition to having castrated priests, which is an interesting thing in light of later practice, one of the rituals of the worship of Cybele was what was known as the Torabolium. And excuse my weak drawing skills here, I was just scribbling that during the last session. But here is a platform, and underneath the platform is the Galli, now ordained, wearing his white rose. And up here is a bull that's being sacrificed by attendants up here. And the blood from the bull drips over the platform onto the robes of the priest, who is thereby purified.
So when you read in Revelation about those who washed their robes clean in the blood of the Lamb, you might think Turribolium, which is certainly what any reader in Roman Asia would have thought. This is not, it's obscure to us. It wasn't obscure to them. It was just daily life to them. So in the midst of all this, you know, what do you do if you're a Christian? How do you live in these cities? What do? In the midst of the imperial cult, the local cults, you know, this pressed upon reality where people are looking to find some way to be bonded with one another, to find some means of security and survival. What do you do? What function does church have in your life?
You form your own cult.
Form your own cult. Well, maybe we won't use the word cult.
Right.
Exactly.
We'll call it church.
Call it church. I mentioned earlier this week, you know, the Greek term that's translated church, and it's not, I don't like it translated church, because church is inherently for us a religious word that's associated with institutions and buildings. Ecclesia in the singular, ecclesia in the plural, comes from the Greek, ecclesia, called out. You know, it is a political term, not a religious term at all. It's the representative assembly in the Greek democratic days, who were those who represented the community in a you know, early sense of democracy. Those who gathered together to make decisions about how should we live together in light of our philosophy and such in the Athenian days. In the later days, by this time, it's how do we live in light of our, you know, other religious practices, in the light of our worldview. So choosing a Greek political term to name the Christian assembly was to suggest, that I put out there, and we can talk about it, that the Christian community was intended to be an alternative assembly. Okay? Not something you do on Sunday morning for an hour, you know, not something apart from your life that perhaps enriches the rest of your life in some way, and that if you're an active parishioner, you know, you volunteer and you, you know, do a few more hours a week than just Sunday morning, but it's still more or less apart from the rest of your life. Because, you know, in our post-Enlightenment reality, church and state, church and economy, church and work are all kind of separate functions. Okay. In their world, they were not separate functions. And in choosing this term to designate the Christian community in this context of urban life, remember, Paul was writing to people in cities too. The word ecclesia is very rare in the Gospels. It's in Matthew. It's really not in the other Gospels at all. It's a term that Luke uses a little bit in Acts, but not much. But he does later. Specifically, though, to refer to ecclesiae in cities like Jerusalem, Antioch. And specifically when he's describing Paul's journeys to these very places, places like Corinth. So they're urban Christian communities, not rural Christian communities. The term ecclesia wouldn't make any sense to peasants in a village. They wouldn't know that term. They wouldn't know what that meant in terms of how to shape their relationships with one another. Okay. Paul uses this language because he goes to cities. John of Patmos uses this language because he's writing to cities, some of the same cities. Okay. So what might that mean? What might that imply for our ecclesiae? Just got a few minutes to put you on the hook here.
We are called out to be different from our society.
Yeah. What might that mean concretely? What would you do differently tomorrow to express that?
Well, you would refrain from participating in the celebrations to the cult of Sibley and maybe
is the cult of Sibley celebrated in your community?
Yeah.
Is there a parallel, or is this just curious history about the ancient world that doesn't mean much for our world?
Not to sweep under the rug things, it's just a part of what everyone's doing, so we could go along and do it, and so the Christian has somehow noticed what we're doing, should be reflective of what we believe.
Okay. So what we do, everything we do, not just what we do at church, is reflective of what we believe. You know, as we'll see a little bit when we look at, those of you here next week, I know it won't be too many, so I'm not risking it too much by saying it now,
When we look at the role of the heavenly liturgy in Revelation, it's almost always that liturgy in Revelation is a statement of loyalty. That worship of God alone means we worship God, and implicitly, not Caesar. So when you get together to sing songs in church, you're making a political statement. Who are we loyal to? That's what politics is, after all, is making decisions together. Where's our loyalty? Who are our people? Who is us? Is our us defined ethnically, nationally, denominationally, or covenantally? I suggest Revelation ultimately is about the latter. That whoever claims to be God's people and living God's ways live in New Jerusalem now. Not at the end of time, not after you die, right now.
How difficult that is when patriotism is so enmeshed with religious beliefs in our society.
How difficult it is when economics is enmeshed with religious beliefs in our society, in addition to that. And in a very, an incredibly propagandistic way that we'll look at in some detail for those of you next week, it's all in the book, so another advertisement. But how, you know, in the ancient world, in the world we're talking about here, it was obviously religious. You know, the cult of Cybele, Roman imperial stuff, by definition religious. In our world, it's a little more subtle than that. Seductive. We don't claim empire. Nobody claims to be an empire now. You know, we don't take our secularized realities and nobody worships the military, nobody worships the free market. And yet, I'd suggest that's largely what's happening. The theologian Harvey Cox, that many of you may know, had a nice story in the Atlantic Monthly a few months back, not about Revelation, but about responding to an invitation by a friend of his to read the Wall Street Journal in light of its religious language. And at first he went, oh. But he did it, and he wrote the story about the free market as God. And how all the imagery of free market is about the free market is a divinity. And if you argue with the religion of the free market, you're a heretic. If you suggest that capitalism isn't the divinely inspired way of having an economy, you're a heretic. And yet, I suggest, Revelation is calling then and now for us to form our economics, our politics, our relationships, not on empire's ways, but on God's ways, first from the covenant and then from the gospel. We forget sometimes how much the central message of the Bible all the way through is about, I would suggest, the central issue is economic. I know some people were at Mary Lowe's talk last night where the question was about sin. And I wasn't there, but I was talking to Mary at breakfast, and I said, you know, what did you define as sin? And it started off with the question of sin as pride from the traditional perspective, and then went into sin as other kinds of things, powerlessness and such. But I would suggest that at least the collective definition of sin in the Bible is collaboration with empire. Put negatively, refusal of covenant. That God has offered us a way to live, and we turn it down. We refuse it. We say, no, thank you. We'd rather not live according to sabbatical and jubilee, and where it says, better not be taking interest from your neighbor. That's a sin. Take interest. No, thank you. We won't live that way. We'll live according to empire. And Revelation speaks in the powerful language it does because it's trying to wake people up out of that and say, that's the road to hell, folks. You know, that's the way of the beast. That's the way of the dragon. The way of God is a very different way that you know in your heart, you know in your memory. And all I, John of Patmos, am trying to do is remind you of something that you already know, but have been seduced into forgetting. Okay. 10 o'clock, I need to stop. So tomorrow, if you have questions, I'm happy to stick around for a few minutes. Tomorrow, I'd invite you, if you have time, to read Revelation 2 and 3, which is the messages to the seven ecclesiae. And I'd invite you to consider what it would be like to have a message like this given to your church. So you see in the messages, everybody gets to hear the evaluation by the risen Jesus of everybody else's community. That's a thing in itself. But I invite you to pay attention to which of these communities seems more like yours. You know, it's like a divine report card in there. This is what I approve of that you're doing well. This is what I think you're not doing so well. And if you don't do it right, there's consequences here. So I invite you just to reflect on this in light of your own communities. Not again as to be harsh, but to recognize that would we rather be comfortable in a lie, or we'd rather be honest and repent and be about living the gifted life that God is calling us to. Okay? That's what we'll do tomorrow. Again, for those who are interested, there are sign-ups for the book here, which includes all this stuff in great gory detail. Okay. Thanks. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow.